Thanks. I think we're all ambivalent about it. And that's an interesting question. What have we learned from the first phase, and how to proceed for the next 2 years, if we want to proceed at all? I think this was quite a long storytelling here, different success, smaller and bigger success stories. I think we should now take your questions and comments for a bit, and then take a second round here. So we have a mobile microphone somewhere, wireless over there. Here's one more. So whoever has questions, please raise your hands.
Test, test, test. Okay. Please don't look at me when you want to talk. Please look at Mr. Benrad, for he's the moderator and gets to decide. We have about 45 minutes. Please wait for the microphone, for you probably want to be heard, and you're also on the audio stream. So please wait for the microphone and maybe put your question into a nutshell if possible. Thank you.
And could somebody please switch on the light? It's getting a bit dark here.
Light's coming up here.
Ah, thanks.
So who's first?
What?
Anyone?
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, I don't know if it's a question or a remark, but I sympathize with the idea that the human rights organizations, you know, get to know civil cyber rights groups and free software movements. But I think there's also something that we should really look into if we sort of mix these groups or do that copy-paste process, you know, of taking over each other's programs. And I think there's a lot of work has been done lately by theorists and critics that really look into the rhetoric of the so-called global civil society. And I think we should really, I think that it is not appropriate to just copy-paste the idea of civil society or civil society organizations without at least putting a question mark behind it. You know, at least we should mention here that, okay, we're not representing anybody. We're not representing the population. We're not even representing our own organization, because we don't even know whether our own organization is democratic or not, whether it has members or, you know. So you're not representing anyone, and you're not representing civil society. And I think that at least, you know, okay, well, we can then start from there, you know, who we are and what we're doing, what we're fighting for. But, you know, to sit amongst the table and say, well, hi, you are the corporations, and over there, you are the governments, and we are civil society, and we sit here and decide over the future of this planet, I find extremely problematic. And I think this should at least, you know, be discussed. I'm not giving an alternative here immediately. You know, in the same way as we have this ongoing debate about ICANN, whether you know the internet should be governed by private corporations or by governments. I mean, this is an extremely problematic thing, you know, to do and to give back the internet governments to countries like China. Nobody wants to go there, of course not. Huh? But at least, well, I wanted to have some discussion about this.
Shall we answer directly or take some more questions? If you can be brief, Jeanette, maybe you answer.
Okay, I just want to amplify what Gea just said. I think we have a tendency to treat civil society as an actor. But what it is actually is more a communicative space, but not one type of agency that would act in a uniform way. And also what I notice is that we have a tendency to celebrate ourselves. And I think there is no reason to do so.
This issue of representativity is very important. I think this is one of the ways how the organizers of the World Summit have been trying to undermine our work. I mean, just the point of calling civil society in to observe and comment, but then not telling anybody. Because, I mean, World Summit of Civil Society, all of you had heard about this, and that's probably why you're here, but most of the public don't even know it was there. It's one of the best kept secrets of the UN. If you were to plan some kind of terrorist attack, do it over the mailing lists of the WSIS, because it's nobody reads them. Yeah? And so... this lack of representativity is actually, I think, very something of which the organizations that are there are very aware of, and I don't think there are. Maybe there are some, but I think most organizations that are at the World Summit are there because, well, they somehow found out about the summit and decided, well, that. There's something, we must do something about it. But not because anybody's is thinking this is going to be, we're going to be the saviors of the world or anything like that. Far from it. There's really very little chance that we can even do anything about it.
If I may add a short comment myself, there was this debate, of course, among ourselves also, and still going on, who are we to decide or at least try to participate in the decision about the future of the planet. But on the other hand, there was also a discussion that was not really, at least to my understanding, not really held broadly enough about the general strategic question. Should we really participate in this official process, which takes a lot of money, it takes a lot of time, you know, these preparatory conferences went on for 2 weeks sometimes, most of them, takes a lot of effort and somehow steals your time and energy to discuss among our own groups, you know, when you only do the lobbying and the submitting input and stuff like that. So this question of inside or outside of this official process is also one that needs to be discussed more, I think. Some people actually said what they did in this summit process was to take the usual demonstrators off the streets and ignore them inside. Okay, Heather is next, I think.
So you left it as kind of a question at the end of the discussion about now civil society must decide whether they're going to put more effort and time into WSIS in the future. I was at one of the prep comms and I found it exhausting, and I really say thank you so much for the people that were involved, because I know how much effort and energy goes into something like this. And I was involved for like a month at that, and you guys have been involved for, I know, a long time. So thank you very much for that. But what is the kind of thought process that goes into an organization, an NGO, deciding that they want to carry on with this process for another 2 years? Because as you've just said, Ralph, it's a huge expenditure, and as civil society, what we should be doing is we should be there with the grassroots organizations making change, and instead we have these amazing people that are sitting engaged in a discussion. So yeah, I'd just like someone to maybe talk about a bit about how that decision is being made, if it is being made at the moment.
Well, those decisions are obviously individual to the different people in civil society, because in the end, you know, there's nobody who can, you know, sort of make or break the decision for all of civil society. I can tell you that we, as an FSF Europe, have thought about this quite a bit during our General Assembly a few weeks ago, and we have been discussing, should we participate in the World Summit, you know, should we do the second phase or should we not do it, and we have decided to do it, but also because for us it is quite normal to work in a relatively abstract field to begin with. I mean, all these laws are very abstract, and we find ourselves facing issues that are often caused on exactly that level. I mean, they are, you know, decided on that level and then filtered down in terms of laws that come at us that are then unstoppable, because everybody says, oh no, we agreed on that on the international level, so we have to implement it now. And so for us, it's sort of a daily experience to have that, you know, situation of a law comes down at you, and at that point you have a really hard time fighting it at all. All you can do is try to prevent the worst. And so for us, we decided, yes, we're going to do it, for the simple reason that if we know what is going on that level, then we have a better idea of what is going to hit us in 5 or 6 or 10 years. So for us, that was more or less the reasoning why we decided to remain in there. How it is for other organizations, well, yeah, I mean, I think there's as many answers as there are organizations in the end.
Maybe even more. Okay.
Just briefly, Robin and Ricky, there are some more questions.
Well, we decided to get involved in this process because in the field that we work in, intellectual property rights, these laws are being made at an international level. What happens at the international level sort of trickles down, and then different countries implement what gets decided in these international treaty body making forums. And while this isn't an official treaty body making forum, there were, you know, hundreds of countries represented. There was something like 60 or 70 heads of state who participated in this process. And they're all going to go back to their home country now and implement or work towards implementing what gets decided in these different plans of action and declaration of principles. So for us, it was a question of, we can't afford not to be involved in this process because the issues are too crucial and the stakes are too high for us not to get involved in helping get it right at an international level, such that when it comes down to individual countries passing different laws or states, that they will get it right as a result.
Okay, just briefly, from a human rights perspective, the main challenge is implementation. That's just how it is. You have tons of formal commitment to all kinds of standards at all kinds of levels, and as we know, there are also tons of problems going on. So in that sense, the whole first process was a bit tiresome, because it was basically over and over again getting governments to reaffirm commitments that were already made. That was so frustrating. I mean, basically getting in the document reaffirmation of stuff that was agreed upon 50 years ago. But anyway, it needs to be done. And it is in there now. But now I think a lot of us, at least some of the people I speak to from the human rights world, are really, really tired of this part of it and wants very much to move on to implementation and a bit of the perspective that I spoke to earlier. To a larger degree, educate at the local level, or rather bridge this gap so that people and various communities become stronger and better in claiming their rights at the local level, to hold the community responsible for what is actually agreed upon. So very concretely, for instance, if you want to promote free software in Berlin, then you get a stronger understanding of how you can actually do that with human rights arguments. And human rights arguments, I believe, are strong because they go back to legal texts that governments have signed. So I actually think this link is pretty important to make. And this is where I personally feel like investing most of my energy now.
Okay, then I think next is Andre, and then you. Over there.
I was very enraged at the World Summit about the lack of IT competence at the UN level and all the groups involved. For instance, the UN published the list of all participants and of the media on the internet with all email addresses and so on. So we got a lot of spam from government institutions who invited us to special meetings with long word attachments The Cato Institute sent us spam about a publication they provided, and this really made me angry because you don't send a Word attachment. You can send a PDF or another file, or just put the text into a usual email when you want to inform about a document. The main issue that I think is important on the UN level is how to create more information efficiency. It was so much paper produced, so much concepts for the initiation of other concepts, and so much cloud talks, but no really substantial operational work. So what can civil society do in order to encourage governments, in order to encourage the UN and also the industry to be more precise and don't waste our time with so much paper and so much text and so much general concepts that are pure waste of our time.
I think that was not really a question, right? Next to you, Hifon.
Thank you. I actually had a sort of like a comment as a response to a question of whether the NGOs shall be present on this high-level discussion. From the point of view of a public official of a unknown country, of a developing unknown country, I could, you know, express my view. I think that it's very important that the NGOs keep, you know, attending this type of meetings, because many times the officials that are present in those type of events have no awareness of many of the real issues that maybe the developed countries want to bring in the table. So it's very useful to have the advice, or at least to hear the, you know, the news from a different perspective, because usually between the delegates, it won't share in all the, you know, the risk that are involved in each of the discussions. So I think it's very important the NGOs to be present there. Thank you.
Over there, next.
Hi, I think the other area which the IT civil society can learn from is the experiences in the trade area, where civil society have been more effective in the WTO processes. And I think maybe the IT civil society, the WSIS process, we could learn lessons from how civil society has been participating at the WTO and some of the gains that they've made. The other issue of linking human rights, I think, is critical, so that what can happen is when we look at human rights issues in the IT area, we should publicize them and have advocacy campaigns. So for instance, if let's say Cisco sells routing systems to China and then they use that for human rights abuses or surveillance, how do we actually create those linkages to create a human rights link? And only after that, if you develop advocacy campaigns, and it's happening a lot in Africa, whether it's Tunisia, Zimbabwe, we've got very repressive governments, and they buy these systems from corporations in the north. So that linkage in the human rights area can make it tangible for people to understand the information society more seriously. I think the dramatic thing at the last WTO, Korean farmer burnt himself because of farm subsidies. You know, we're not going to get people that's going to, you know, demonstrate dramatically about free software, for instance. You know, so how do you communicate to the public that this is a bread and butter issue to ordinary citizens? And I think some of the ideas we can begin to think about for the next 2 years.
Okay. Any more questions or comments from you? Otherwise, we could make another round here.
Any more statements?
Okay.
You were mentioning, well, most of you were mentioning that the results or outcomes, the official ones of WSIS, were not so good. But for you, it was very valuable in the sense that you got to know each other, all these different groups within civil society, networking started, etc. So I guess for the next round, it should be more than networking. What is your idea on how, even if it's not an actor, civil society, but different groups, to speak with one voice next time, or with, let's say, less voices than the last time? What are your ideas on this and how to go about it?
Any more comments, questions?
Maybe I can talk. I can answer a bit.
Annette was.
I thought nobody wanted.
Thank you. Well, first of all, I'd like to say that I disagree with the opinion that the government declaration of the last year is a bad declaration. I think it used to be a bad declaration in the beginning where they planned this declaration. In the end, because of civil society intervention, this government declaration, now the official declaration of the World Summit, is a useful paper, and I really want to stress this point because I think that this paper is useful for your work, for our work. We can refer to the issue that privacy is an issue, and that if they talk about security and the necessity of surveillance, that in this government paper, they wrote down that there is a conflict between, on the one hand, surveillance for security reasons and the issue of privacy, and that there is a need for privacy. So I think there are many points, many issues, which are very important to us, and of course, it's not the best. It's not what we would have liked to get, but it's quite a good paper now. And I think we should discuss more about what could be done and what could be a sort of different declaration in a way that we should focus on certain issues where we have to have more rights because it's not developed yet, but it's not a bad paper. I think it's something we can refer to. That's the one thing. The other thing is, your question was to speak in one voice. We cannot speak in one voice. It is impossible because, as it was mentioned, we cannot even speak for our country, we cannot even speak for Berlin. We can, you know, I have a hard time. I have to speak for my organization, which is the largest union in the world, and it's very difficult to speak there because it's like a government. I have to ask if I really, you know, go for a declaration, and I say, oh, now I have to ask this person and this branch and so on. And in some cases, I just prefer to write my personal name. You know, so sometimes I just say I'll be on the safe side, and it's just me. It's one person on this earth, Annette. You know, so it's difficult. But on the other hand, I think we can learn something. First of all, we have to learn that language is the major problem. Before we talk about IT access, we have to talk about what language can we use. And it was really a difficulty that we had translation only in the official sessions and in some civil society official panels, but all the discussions going on in the lobby, which are, as everyone knows, the most important discussions in the Döner Kebab place, where we really write down things, there was a real huge advantage for English-speaking people. I mean, it's just unbelievable how big this advantage was. And I think talking about information society and speaking in one voice, we have to somehow solve the problem of give a voice to those who don't speak English.
This is a famous Döner place we went on.
Be amazed what a power they have. They are, I mean, I can very much identify with them, not with the whole declaration, but certainly with the first part. So it isn't as bad as it could have been. And I also want to comment on the question of whether civil society will be able to speak with one voice. For example, for my area, internet governance, we hope to be formally included in the new working group on internet governance. So the Internet Governance Caucus needs to form structures able to have, say, the ability for formal consensus building. And I have no idea how to get at this point right now. We are not representative. We are just a couple of people who are interested in this field, perhaps 20 active members. I have no idea, and these 20 people reflect a broad diversity of point of views. So I have no idea how we will do this. And I've come to think that governments have a huge advantage, and that is they have sort of they have routines how to solve such problems, how to manage situations where many people do represent different interests. We have to learn that, and we have to become more professional in this respect. And the problem is, of course, that we lack the means. Most of us do this on a voluntary basis. We have neither the funding, nor the time, nor the expertise to solve such problems.
Veni also was taking part in the summit process.
This one is... Oh, is it working? Yeah, it's working now. I was kind of involved in the process of the WSIS since the early prepcoms and the WSIS itself, and I just wanted to bring you to the point where we talk now about internet governance and a number of other issues, but the truth is that there is no money for the WSIS itself. Not talking about money for participation of civil society. I mean, there is not a clear view whether the WSIS will happen in Tunisia next year. And as you probably, some of you know, that there is a Swiss guy, Markus Kummer, who was appointed to head the secretariat to the working group that will be appointed by the Secretary General to work on internet governance. He doesn't have money for the secretariat itself. So practically, I don't see any future for the WSIS as long as no country has allocated funds for it. I think on the website it says something like 8% of the needed amount of money is already there. And we can talk about civil society participation, we can talk about what the important issues according to us, but I don't think this is really worth doing it, because if there is no wishes, why should we waste time and efforts to find money to participate in something which may never happen?
Any comments on that? Maybe I can comment myself briefly on what the others said before. I also agree that the final official summit declaration is not that bad. It's just not as good as we had hoped for, and of course it's not as good as the civil society declaration. But I think what we always have to add, and this is an important point, that it was due to the heavy involvement and efforts of civil society groups also that the summit declaration became much better than the first drafts. One of our colleagues from Switzerland once said, the civil society groups really helped to move the whole discussion from information, read ICTs, to society. And that was the big, I think, impact we had. When the World Summit process started, the general idea was give the internet to everybody in the world and everybody will be happy and the world will be a perfect place, or at least close to. And of course, that was also one idea to open new markets for the ICT industry of the North. And what we did, I think, pretty well with the help of some friendly governments was to shift the whole discussion from this technological focus to the human focus and to bring the point across that in the end it's not about digital, it's about dignity. The other thing, what Vanni just said, that there might not even be a summit next year because there's no money and nobody is really interested besides the Tunisian government itself, and they don't have as much money as the Swiss had. I think that might be true. I think there will be a summit somehow. I mean, they can't decide on a summit and then just not let it happen. But the question is, of course, how important will it be? And my assessment is that now it's definitely going to be different than the first phase. Somebody here said, okay, you did the networking in the first phase, so what's next? You should build on that and do something more. I think it was you, right? And there was the governments also say, okay, we have agreed on this final summit declaration last December after very, very tough negotiations over almost 2 years. We don't want to open it up again. It's just too exhausting. And we have an agreement, so let's just keep it closed and focus on implementation and so on. And the way I see it is that now, especially if it's more about implementation, it's more about not just the summit itself, but how these principles of the summit that were agreed upon there are in a way spread all over the other important and maybe even more important institutions like WTO, like WIPO, like whatever, Human Rights Commissioners works and so on. And this of course makes it more complex because it's many more institutions that have to be covered. It's not just one process, it's a couple of different parallel processes, and to link these together in a feasible way that civil society groups can have some influence there will be a bit more tricky, of course. But on the other hand, and I agree with Ricky there, that's a real challenge. The summit last year just produced two papers, the summit declaration of principles and the plan of action. And now the second phase and the follow-up till 2015, whatever, will be about these papers and these diplomats meet the real world. And that's, of course, where a lot of NGOs and grassroots groups have much, much more experience than these diplomats and can help and are really important for that. If you're more interested about these discussions, what to do next, and especially what to do in Tunisia and so on when the next summit preparatory conferences take place, we have a full-day workshop on Sunday on the World Summit on the Information Society, where many more people who couldn't be here today, who have been heavily involved in the summit process, will be there also. The location and everything is in the program. So if you're interested, you're more than welcome. Okay, any more questions? Okay, one more.
I just wanted to ask why the alternative conference was raided by the Swiss police.
Okay. Well, the question was, why was the alternative conference raided by the Swiss police? The conference was very critical of the WISIS summit, and they were holding it in this warehouse, and they'd gotten the permission from the tenant of the warehouse to hold it there, but law enforcement apparently contacted the owner of the building and told the owner of the building, do you know this meeting is going to happen? And the owner said, no, these must be trespassers. And so they showed up in their full riot gear and their big boots and all their guns, and these were just people with computers getting ready to talk about the WISIS conference. And so... Then the folks had to call the tenant, and the tenant came down and said, yes, I gave them permission, and they can have it here. But at that point, the owner was like, no way, and so they had to take it somewhere else. And there was a lot of press were getting interested in this, because this was, there was a lot of press at the World Summit, and we were calling them, telling them to come down, and we're going to hold a press conference on this. And so the police were getting very nervous, because they were looking pretty bad. And so they said, okay, we'll find a new location for you to hold your meeting a few blocks away. And so everyone was happy for the press conference. And then, we trudged on down to the new building, and it turned out the new building had no idea that these arrangements had been made. So it looked, it had appeared had appeared that it had all been solved, but it hadn't. And so then the next thing, the organizers of the alternative event were very upset, and they're like, we're going to hold this event in the streets unless you actually give us a space now. And so then the police did, in fact, make some alternative arrangements and allowed them to have the event to go on at another place and agreed to pay for installing the internet connection. And so it was resolved, but there was several days of disruption. There was at least a day and a half where all the speeches and panels were canceled, and there was enormous disruption. And quite frankly, the police just they seemed to lie about having the authority to grant this space the first time. It was all done because the press were there, and they didn't want to look bad for the press. So that's the long and short of it. We've got pictures on our website.
And the alternative summit was for us the alternative in the evening, because we had no internet at the whole World Summit on Information Society, where they wanted to talk about bridging the digital gap. And it was very spießig, we call it in German. And we were every evening very happy to go over to the alternative summit to have some activist videos and good music and so forth and all that stuff. And yeah, for us it was relaxing in Geneva outside of the Döner Lounge.
Well, I guess. Yeah, actually, this whole wireless thing, that was really telling. You know, during these preparatory conferences, it was totally normal and standard that there was wireless that worked. It was provided by the ITU. It was just across the street for all the conference participants. No problem. It worked. No costs. We could even use the network printers and everything. No problem. So everybody who came to the summit was expecting at least the same, maybe even some better stuff, you know, some more fancy printers or better bandwidth or whatever. And then when we registered at the summit, we found this small card from Swisscom in our papers and documents that said, oh yeah, you can rub here and then you get this code and it's worth 2 hours of wireless. But you can't even split it into like 10-minute blocks for just checking your emails. Once you start, the 2 hours start to run, it are over. So, and we were there for a whole week, and if we wanted to have more of internet connectivity, we would have to pay like 200 euros or something for the week. I think Vanny said at that occasion that in Bulgaria, where he's from, people live off that money for 2 months, you know.
It was our most successful press text.
Yeah.
And it was totally crazy. They had a very big internet cafe with 150 computers running on Linux, and nobody had access to SSL connection, to SMTP, to nothing, so nobody was able to check mails there. And we did a lot of pressure to get one cable of Ethernet, and we did our press text, and some students from Switzerland wrote mails, oh, I have an access point, and where shall I bring it to you? And we created our own free network around this small Ethernet cable around the civil society offices, and yeah, so that was the only chance on the whole World Summit on Information Society to check mails. And yeah.
In the end, the journalists started to hang out there to be able to send their articles out. Yeah. It was so typical, you know.
It and that net had the network ID Freedom, of course.
Yeah.
Well, okay. Good luck on the next one.
Yeah, thanks for being here and hope to see at least some of you on Sunday. Thanks.